Hello guys, this is your host Pratoy Chowdhury, presenting episode 9 of Troubled Mind. I know previously that I promised you guys that I'd be out with this episode about a week after episode 8, and that should have been a week and a half ago, but unfortunately, you know, life just happened for me and I got caught up with a lot of different things, family stuff, projects, some of the things that I wanted to do on my own, and as a result, I just simply didn't have the time to pretty much record or even write the script for this. So, you know, some of it, I can probably blame it on myself and procrastination in general, but, you know, the other part, it was just, you know, a time constraint. So I'm sorry if I kept you guys waiting. But with that, I think I've prepared a really thought-provoking episode for episode 9. I think you guys are really going to realize that this question is, you know, something that we can relate to today and probably, you know, hundreds of years back. And ultimately, today, we are going to be discussing a very, very pressing and urgent event in modern American history. This is the shooting of Trayvon Martin. Hope you guys strap yourselves in for this one. If you guys haven't already subscribed or left a review or a rating for A Troubled Mind, please do. I really appreciate it. And this has helped me to realize, you know, what I'm doing right, what I'm doing wrong, and what I can do to make the episodes even more exciting for you guys. Also, if you guys have any suggestions, please feel free to DM me on Instagram at atroubledmindpodcast, at atroubledmindpodcast, or, you know, even email me at atroubledmindpodcast@gmail.com. So with this, let's get into it, guys. I want us all to take a moment to question implicit bias and how that affects our decisions. So if you see a man passing as you walk back home on a late night, does the race of that man make any difference to whether you're afraid or not? So if it was a white man or a black man, would that make a difference? What if the man was Latino or Asian? Would that change what you thought about that man and how safe you were feeling at that moment? Would the attire or the appearance of the man make a difference? If the man wore, say, a white hoodie or a black hoodie or had tattoos visible on his arms or neck or even his face, would that make you more scared than if it was a man, you know, dressed in a simple t-shirt and jeans without any tattoos? The truth is about implicit bias, guys. We try, all right, and no matter how much we try to eliminate implicit bias, an innate sense to judge someone because of their race, religion, and sexuality, it's still so, so common, right? Like, we can't just get past this. And frankly, I think it's part of being human. It's part of the human experience. Humans have retained a lot of their mental and physical attributes from prehistoric times. And anticipating danger was a very common and important issue during prehistoric times, right? So obviously, as civilization hadn't developed yet, you know, safety was a concern at that time. So whenever ancient humans would walk, they had to keep their eyes, ears, and nose scanning the environment, scanning for threats. And whenever one human saw a stranger passing by, you know, he'd normally assume that stranger to be a threat, an enemy, somebody who posed them significant amounts of harm. And a lot of the times, humans would take preemptive actions, you know, as we've seen in a lot of the cases, to stop the perceived threat from causing harm. And, you know, I think in our modern times, with the cases that we've seen, a lot of the times these preemptive strikes or preemptive actions can prove to be very, very damaging and destructing to the entire nation, to the family that was hurt, to the victim himself, and to the larger question of racism, frankly. Now, is that just? You know, what if the perceived threat is not a threat at all? What if the stranger is just another common friendly stranger just going about his business? What then? If you happen to harm him, is that on you or is that on the system itself? So as we dive deeper into our story this week, please ask yourself these questions about what qualifies someone as a threat, and how implicit bias plays into your perception of somebody as a threat or as a friend. Our story takes us back all the way into Sanford, Florida, around 2011-2012. Sanford, Florida is a cozy seaside town in Florida with nice views and a population of roughly 60,000 people. So there was a gated community that was made up of about 260 individual units in this town. And the townhome committee was named The Retreat, or the Twin Lakes. Now, the racial profile of the residents at The Retreat was pretty diverse, actually. 49% of the residents were Caucasian, 23% were Hispanic, 20% were African Americans, and 5% were Asian American. Unfortunately, this community was plagued with crime and safety issues from pretty much its inception. And from 2011, this grew even hotter and it became a much more pressing problem. So during the time span of between the start of 2011 through February of 2012, the community had called the police about 402 times. The crimes that were reported as having occurred included 8 burglaries, 9 thefts, and 1 shooting. Along with that, the residents of the community had mentioned multiple cases of break-ins into particular units by strangers. Ultimately, at one point, the community was forced to take action against the crimes and violence that had become almost the norm in the community. Because obviously, you know, you need community-wide intervention to prevent these crimes in the first place, because obviously, you know, the cops are doing their jobs, but it's only after the damage has been done, right? So ultimately, the community at The Retreat realized that things needed to change and that The Retreat needed to become a safer space. And so in September of 2011, The Retreat residents came together to discuss safety measures intended to make their community a much safer place. Their final plan comprised of a neighborhood watch program. Basically, this included certain elected members of the community who would be trusted with serving voluntary shifts where they would keep a lookout for suspicious criminal activity or suspicious strangers who were hanging out in the community. Mr. George Zimmerman was elected by the community at The Retreat as the program coordinator. He is going to be one of the driving characters of this case, story, whatever you want to call it, so please do remember him. Now, purely judging by the books, Mr. Zimmerman seemed to be an aware, vigilant member of the community. In the past, he'd made about 50 different phone calls to the police to report various kinds of suspected disturbances and crimes in his neighborhood. Now, most of the times, these weren't very serious, right? It was just a bunch of kids in the community, you know, basically having a good time, but creating a lot of noise and, you know, pretty much being boisterous with their noisy parties and things. Or other times, it could have been a bit more serious, such as strangers trespassing private property and looking through windows and examining what people have in their houses, right? And also, Mr. Zimmerman had held a personal firearms license since November 2009. Now, the community watch program seemed to be doing a good job, actually. You know, things had cooled down a bit. People were a bit more relaxed, obviously. And then in February of 2012, a couple of new faces popped up at The Retreat. So, Trayvon Benjamin Martin was a 17-year-old high school student who lived with his mother, Sabrina Fulton, in Miami Gardens, Florida. And his mother, Miss Fulton, had separated from his father, Tracy Martin, and so Trayvon would pretty much go back and forth between his mom and his dad. And he primarily lived with his mom in Miami Gardens, obviously, because that's where he went to high school. But he often spent longer holidays with his dad. And he'd spend this at The Retreat in Sanford, Florida. Now, after being caught at school with drug residue in his backpack around mid-February, Trayvon received a 10-day suspension from Crop Senior High, which is where he went to school. Now, seeing that he didn't have school for pretty much the next 2 weeks, Trayvon decided it'd be better to just head up to his dad's place and, you know, spend the time with his dad. Now, Mr. Tracy Martin lived with his fiancée, obviously, at The Retreat in Sanford, and so he took his son, Trayvon, with him there. However, nobody could imagine that this simple visit with one's dad would turn out to have deadly consequences for Trayvon, his parents, the entirety of America, and of course, the residents at The Retreat. On the evening of February 26, 2012, Trayvon left his dad's unit at the retreat where his father lived with his fiance to go to a nearby convenience store. Now, it's been reported that he purchased a pack of Skittles and an Arizona fruit cocktail beverage at the nearby 7-Eleven. And afterwards, around, you know, 7-ish p.m., Trayvon was returning back to his father's residence. Now, after Trayvon entered the gated community, he felt as if somebody was spying on him and having him followed. Soon, around 7.09 p.m. of that day, there was a ring at the desk of the Sanford Police Department. The dispatcher, just anticipating some kind of regular trouble going on, picked up, right? It was probably just something that wasn't as serious. Now, it turned out that the person spying on Trayvon was Mr. Zimmerman, Mr. George Zimmerman, who we talked about, who was appointed as pretty much the community leader for the Community Watch Program. Mr. Zimmerman at the time was off duty from his community's neighborhood watch program, and he's reported to have been driving through the neighborhood for a personal errand. However, as he was pulling out of the neighborhood to go where he intended, he spotted Trayvon. And, you know, he didn't recognize Trayvon because obviously Trayvon was not living at the retreat all the time. He'd come here mainly to visit his dad and spend time during his holidays. Now, according to Mr. Zimmerman and his legal counsel, there were a couple of reasons why he suspected Trayvon posed criminal intent. Firstly, the weather outside wasn't really all that pleasant that day and that night. It was a cloudy, damp, rainy day in Sanford, and so the weather conditions didn't really suit walking, let alone walking at a very comfortable pace. Mr. Zimmerman described Trayvon as walking in a very relaxed manner, not looking like he was in a hurry to reach home. Now, several things in the phone call between Zimmerman and the police dispatcher kind of stand out. Firstly, Zimmerman said he looks to be up to no good when referring to Trayvon. He also said, these assholes, they always get away. Now, could these have been racially intended or intended to stereotype, you know, what Trayvon was wearing? Nobody can really confirm that, but, you know, there may have been a certain edge to Mr. Zimmerman's comments and obviously his perspective at the time. So it appears that Mr. Zimmerman continued to tail Trayvon after finishing the phone call with the police dispatcher, even though the dispatcher warned him during the call to maintain his distance from the alleged suspect and obviously not to tail the alleged suspect, which was Trayvon in this case. Unfortunately, from there on, the situation just gets more blurred, and this is where we start to get different versions of the story. Now, it's hard to actually see what happened. Well, you know, we don't really have any hard facts or bias-free accounts to detail what happened in the next 20 minutes. And various different sources have stated various different things. You know, obviously, Mr. Zimmerman's side is going to be saying one thing that's going to favor his side, and obviously Trayvon's parents are going to say something that favors their son, obviously. So we can't really draw a clear, firm conclusion. So Mr. Zimmerman's description of what happened didn't align completely with what neighbors saw in the vicinity as well. But nevertheless, we're going to explore what different people reported.
So right after Zimmerman ended his call with the dispatcher around 7:15, one thing was clear. Things seemed to have gone pretty bad from then on. Between 7:16 p.m. to 7:19 p.m. of that day, there were 8 separate 911 calls from community members living in surrounding housing complexes. There were a couple common aspects in each of the calls' descriptions of events, practically. And, you know, there are about 4 that I really have in mind. Firstly, most of the calls reported there to have been some sort of fight or trouble going on near them. And that's kind of obvious, right? There was an escalation of the conflict. Secondly, it seemed like 2 people were struggling against each other. And in some calls, actually, many of the people reported hearing calls for help in the distance, but they couldn't really distinguish whether this was the voice of Mr. Zimmerman or of Trayvon. And lastly, some of the callers heard gunshots, and in one case, a gunshot was recorded during the 911 call itself. In addition, there were also a couple witnesses who witnessed what happened, or at least so they say. One witness identified himself as John and said he was walking through the retreat, the neighborhood where the killing took place. Apparently, he saw Trayvon Martin leaning or seated on top of Mr. Zimmerman punching him in the face, laying down volley after volley of punches. He also stated that the person yelling help was the person on the bottom, who was wearing a red shirt, implying that it was Mr. Zimmerman who was calling out for help. A 13-year-old boy also offered testimony, which had stated that the man wearing a red shirt, in this case, Mr. Zimmerman, was shouting out for help, but his statements were later retracted by his parents and were not considered by law enforcement or legal counsels when they were obviously presenting their case to the courts. Also, there was a third witness, actually a pair in this case. It was Mary Kucher and her roommate Selma Mora Lamilla, who lived at the retreat. They offered their testimony of the event that they witnessed, although they didn't really have a clear view of what happened. According to them, at least, there wasn't a fight at all. There was no punching or anything or any sort of physical altercation that took place between the two men involved in this event. And they also reported hearing the same yell for help and a sort of whining in the distance before the sound of a gunshot. After the gunshot, they said that the cries for help stopped immediately, according to the two. Now, could the whining and even the yells for help have been from Trayvon Martin? Possibly. Could the whining have been from Trayvon and the yells for help, you know, could they have been from Mr. Zimmerman? That is also a possibility. But one thing's for sure, we'll never know what happened completely. Another witness, and this is our fourth, a woman who was classified as AC360 in the investigation, reported seeing two men involved in a fight with both of them on the ground. According to her, she first heard an argument between a younger and an older voice. After the fight broke out in the grass, according to her, the man who was on top walked away after the gunshot was fired, according to her. However, she did not see any traces of blood on either men. Our fifth eyewitness account. This person later came to the fore of the investigation, claiming to have witnessed the fight between the two individuals. He claimed to see a black man wearing a dark-colored hoodie on top of a white or Hispanic man who was yelling for help. One thing is for clear, he saw a black male on top, according to what he said, and he said that this person who was on top was throwing MMA-style punches. Moments later, he heard a loud pop, and the black individual later fell to the ground before being dragged across the grass. And this was likely Trayvon, very tragically. However, the most shocking account seemed to come not from a witness who was near the scene physically, but a witness who was actually talking to Trayvon on the phone during the incident. According to the Martin family lawyer Benjamin Crump, Trayvon had been on the phone with his friend Rachel Jontel just moments before he was shot dead. He was talking to Ms. Jontel as he was returning from the convenience store, the 7-Eleven. During the interviews with the investigators and ABC News, Ms. Jontel testified to hearing Trayvon say, "What are you following me for?" before the confrontation between Zimmerman and Trayvon unfolded. The man that Trayvon asked the question to responded by asking, "What are you doing around here?" Ms. Jontel would also later add Trayvon referring to Zimmerman as a creepy-ass cracker. However, moments later, she heard some shouting, and then basically the call was dropped soon. Now, there were many, many more details that lawyers from both sides of the case eventually brought up, and it would take hours to parse through every single piece of evidence, but the law enforcement authorities tended to go off of Zimmerman's account of the events, mostly. In fact, Mr. Zimmerman shot a video reenactment of the events that transpired the day of the shooting. Although there are likely plenty of lies mixed into his version of the events, basically his accounts, this is unfortunately the only coherent string of events that we have since obviously Trayvon passed away. Here's his account. According to Ms. Zimmerman, he said he took note of Trayvon because he was near a home he had called the cops about previously. Also, to Zimmerman, it looked like something was off about Trayvon. Zimmerman was then in his truck. After a while, Trayvon rounded the corner of his street and disappeared from view. And this caused Mr. Zimmerman's suspicion to grow. And against the orders of the dispatcher, he set off on foot to track Trayvon. When he returned to the street, he saw that Trayvon had disappeared, and so Zimmerman was completely mystified.
because obviously he expected to encounter Trayvon after he rounded the corner of the street. Zimmerman then turned around and started walking back to his truck. Suddenly, out of the darkness, so to say, Trayvon appeared from sort of the bushes from the side of the street, and he asked what the matter was. Zimmerman said nothing was wrong, obviously. And after his response, the altercation began as Trayvon punched Zimmerman to the ground. Zimmerman was on his back and Trayvon was on top of him, laying down punches at him and trying to hit Zimmerman's head against the side of the curb. Zimmerman then tried to wiggle his way out from under Trayvon, and it was at this moment that Trayvon first saw the gun that Zimmerman was carrying. According to Zimmerman, Trayvon uttered something along the lines of, "You're going to die tonight." Now, I'm not saying that this is exactly what Trayvon said, but according to Mr. Zimmerman, this is what he heard. Zimmerman yelled for help roughly 50 times, according to him, and Trayvon supposedly covered his mouth to muffle the screams for help. Next, Trayvon and Zimmerman both struggled for the firearm. However, Zimmerman got a hold of it first and fired a single shot at a distance of between 6 and 18 inches into Trayvon's chest. By 7:20 p.m. that night, Sanford City Police Department officer Timothy Smith arrived at the scene of the shooting. Smith saw Trayvon lying face down on a bed of grass, senseless. Meanwhile, he observed that Zimmerman's back was wet and covered with grass. According to Officer Smith, Zimmerman was bleeding from the nose and the back of his head, and photos were later taken, and so we can confirm that that was the case. Officer Ricardo Ayala and Sergeant Anthony Raimondo arrived together minutes later. Ayala and Raimondo began CPR on Trayvon. Unfortunately, paramedics from the Sanford Fire and Rescue Department declared Trayvon dead at 7:30 p.m. Zimmerman was taken into custody by the police department after this. He was interrogated by investigator Dee Singleton and Chris Serino for roughly 5 hours before being released that same night. The Sanford City Police Department justified the release of Zimmerman by claiming that Zimmerman had acted in self-defense. And basically, the police chief cited that Zimmerman's actions were perfectly legal under Florida's Stand Your Ground statute, which basically allowed the use of lethal force by citizens when that citizen felt like another citizen was threatening them and that they were under imminent threat. Unfortunately, Trayvon's parents did not know about what happened or anything that happened for that matter to their son that night, and so Trayvon's body was taken to the morgue at first and he was labeled as John Doe. His father called on February 28th to report a missing persons report. Police officers soon met his father at his fiancée's house at 9:20 a.m. the next morning. According to toxicology reports formulated during the autopsy of Trayvon's body, trace amounts of THC were found. The reports found there to be 1.5 milligrams per milliliter of THC and about 7.3 nanograms of THC, 11-oic acid, which is basically what the body breaks down THC into. According to analysts later, Trayvon had likely consumed marijuana days in advance, but they clearly said that it shouldn't have impacted his behavior and decisions during the altercation with Zimmerman, or, you know, anything that he did, as a matter of fact, during that day. And so at first, it was mainly the police department that was investigating this, but then on March 12, 2012, the Sanford City Police Chief transferred the investigation to the state attorney's office for review. The police chief still maintained his stance that there wasn't enough probable cause to arrest Zimmerman, and Zimmerman was still out and about in the public. The state attorney, Norm Wilfinger, initially announced that the Seminole County Grand Jury would be summoned on April 10th to investigate the death of Trayvon Martin. However, after a change of state attorneys, the new state attorney, Angela Corey, jumped straight into the case in the investigation instead of going through a grand jury. And within the next week, around March 20th, March 15th, the FBI, the Florida Department of Law Enforcement, and the DOJ opened parallel investigations into the shooting of Trayvon Martin. After 30 interviews were conducted by the FBI and analyzed by the DOJ, they still didn't show any probable cause to arrest Zimmerman, and Zimmerman was still out and about in the public. When a claim that Zimmerman had racially stereotyped Martin came up, the Sanford City Police investigator Chris Serino reasoned that Mr. Zimmerman had acted on the attire of Trayvon Martin and not his race. However, both the DOJ and the FBI later on discounted their investigations in 2015. Again, as the Sanford City Police Chief talked about, citing lack of evidence to charge Mr. Zimmerman. However, the Martin family would not be silenced by law enforcement, and they refused to accept the police department's accounts of what happened minutes before Zimmerman fired that fatal shot into Trayvon's chest, which caused Trayvon to die sadly. They teamed up with civil rights lawyer Benjamin Crump, who we talked about earlier, and attorney Natalie Jackson, and publicist Ryan Julison. They settled a wrongful death claim on April 5th, 2013, which was basically for an undisclosed amount believed to have been over $1 million with the Twin Lakes Homeowners Association, which is where Tracy Martin and his fiancée were living at the time. Throughout the trial and legal proceedings, they maintained their stance that Trayvon had acted in self-defense and that Zimmerman was responsible for starting the altercation between the two. On April 11, 2012, amid widespread, intense, and in some cases misleading media coverage, Zimmerman was ultimately charged with second-degree murder by a special prosecutor appointed by Governor Rick Scott of Florida. Zimmerman's trial ultimately began on June 10, 2013 in Sanford, Florida. And this is where we ultimately get to the big stage and see if we ultimately gain justice. The public response prior to Zimmerman's indictment was massive. Firstly, Zimmerman was criticized for carrying a firearm through his neighborhood. Secondly, the director of the National Sheriff Association said that Zimmerman's alleged action and decision to carry a firearm with him contradicted the principles of a basic neighborhood watch program, which was basically to alert law enforcement about certain crimes or certain suspicious activities which people thought were, you know, of malintent. Thirdly, protests were also staged nationwide to urge the arrest and indictment of Zimmerman. A petition, in fact, on change.org calling for Zimmerman's arrest got more than 2.2 million signatures worldwide. Also, hoodies were worn as a sign of protest during demonstrations. Prominent athletes, including Carmelo Anthony, LeBron James, Dwayne Wade, and the entire Miami Heat team, wore hoodies in Trayvon's honor. Protesters also marched with bottles of Arizona iced tea and bags of Skittles, which were the last items that Trayvon had been carrying with him before he met his death. Also, thousands of students across the Florida high school system staged walkouts. President Obama, in fact, himself was deeply affected by the killing of Trayvon Martin, and he commented during one of his press briefings, and I quote, "When I think about this boy, I think about my own kids. And I think every parent in America should be able to understand why it is absolutely imperative that we investigate every aspect of this. If I had a son, he would look like Trayvon." And a lot of the media attention surrounded the killing of Trayvon Martin practically. Although the first 10 days of the investigation into the death of Trayvon was only aired on TV channels and networks across Florida, Reuters later reported on it first in early March of 2012. Later on, major American television channels like CBS, NBC, Fox News, and CNN began regularly covering updates on the investigation and the trial for the killing of Trayvon Martin. The Project for Excellence in Journalism reported that media coverage for Trayvon became the first story in 2012 to be more popular than the presidential race during that year between President Obama and Senator Mitt Romney. Unfortunately, during the trial in which the prosecution charged the defense with second-degree murder, the jury found him not guilty on July 13, 2013, due to the lack of evidence again. And as we talked about, on February 24, 2015, the US DOJ announced there wasn't enough evidence for a federal hate crime prosecution to proceed regarding the shooting of Trayvon Martin. And so as a result, Trayvon's parents and basically the entire African-American community never got the closure that they needed. You know, I think that this is probably one of America's darkest hours, and not enough was done to simply make it right. And I think that this is something that even goes on today, you know, with the three recent killings that we saw, Ahmaud Arbery, Breonna Taylor, and George Floyd. And those are only some of the ones that have come to the fore What about hundreds, possibly thousands of these happening every single year? Hundreds of these, in fact, happening every single year because of a corrupt law enforcement, because of a biased law enforcement system in the US. And ultimately, I'm here to break political correctness, and I believe that institutional racism is something that we must fight together, and that's something we have to end together. And I'm very proud that people are finally taking a stance against this, and finally showing that they will not simply stand by, that they will not simply agree with what's going on. I think it's very, very honorable that people are acting out, and acting out for change, showing that they care, and showing that they want a better America and a more fair judicial system. In fact, not only for the US, but for the entire world. And this will ultimately lead us into a more equitable world, a world where the color of our skin does not determine who we are. The color of our eyes does not determine, you know, whether we go to jail or not. And basically a more equitable world where we give people credit because of the thing inside them, because of their merit, because of their stories, because of what they have to say, and where we pride ourselves truly on diversity. That is the true world that I want to witness, and that is the America that I want to see soon. I hope we get there. Thank you guys so much for tuning into episode 9 of A Troubled Mind. If you've listened to the end, I would really appreciate if you guys, you know, commented or left a review or rated my podcast. That is very, very helpful for me. And also, if you have suggestions, DM me at A Troubled Mind Podcast on Instagram. And also feel free to email me at atroubledmindpodcast@gmail.com. Thank you. If you want to reach out, please do. I welcome every single comment, every single thing that every single one of my listeners has to say. And at the end of the day, I just want to break political correctness with you guys and address some of the pressing questions of our times and of times past. Thank you, and I'll be back soon with another episode. I promise I won't keep you guys waiting for as long as I did this last time. It's been 2.5-3 weeks, and you guys won't have to wait that long for the next episode. Thank you so much. I'll see you guys soon.